And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, listeners. This is your summarily genial host, John Derbyshire, with news and commentary on the week's events. I have no front matter at all to offer you this week, so let's proceed straight to the passing charivari. I find it harder and harder to watch passing events without Mike Judge's 2006 movie Idiocracy coming to mind. That's especially the case with politics. Politicians have always said dumb things, of course, but in between the dumb things, they generally, once in a while, said sensible, interesting, or thought-provoking things too. Occasionally, even memorable things. Today, it seems to be all dumb. Wall-to-wall dumb. Sea-to-shining-sea stupidity. Case in point, Joe Biden's speech about voting rights in Philadelphia Tuesday. I listened to all 19 minutes of it, with the idea to do a thorough tossing and goring. However, Pat Buchanan has beat me to it, and I'm not going to compete with the master. So I'll just throw out a few random comments. Joe plumbed the deepest depths of idiocy at 16 minutes and 19 seconds into the CNBC video of the speech. Quote, "The assault on free and fair elections is just such a threat, literally. I've said it before. We're facing the most significant test of our democracy since the Civil War." That's not hyperbole. Since the Civil War. End quote. In fact, as even some institutional never-Trump Republicans were moved to point out, in fact, that is a textbook instance of hyperbole. In saying, "That's not hyperbole," the president said a really dumb, stupid thing, inviting mockery from any literate person. Perhaps Biden, or whoever writes his speeches, just learned the word hyperbole and has taken a fancy to it. He actually used it twice in this speech. The first time at 52 seconds in, quote, "2020 election. It's not hyperbole to say the most examined and fullest expression of the will of the people in the history of this nation." End quote. Well, again, it is hyperbole to say that. Last November's election was a ramshackle affair, mainly because of disruptions due to the COVID pandemic. We have had much better run and more credible elections. Does anyone not think so? That bit of the speech doesn't attain quite the lightless depths of dumbassery as the previous one, but it's pretty darn stupid. When he wasn't saying dumb things, the president was telling lies. He said, for example, that women were denied the right to vote until the 19th Amendment in 1920. Not true. Women got the vote in Wyoming 51 years before that, in 1869, closely followed by Utah, then Colorado and Idaho. Every smart high schooler knows this stuff. What wasn't dumb or false was just embarrassing. Fake indignation, descents into inaudible mumblings, threadbare cliches. Biden who-we-are'd us twice at 14 minutes 26 seconds, 15 minutes 31 seconds. It wasn't hard to see what psychologists call projection, too. Quote, "We're going to face a new test in 2022, a new wave of unprecedented voter suppression and raw and sustained election subversion," end quote. Translation. We in the regime are really, really worried that voters will vote the wrong way next year. We all know what this is about. It's not about 2022 or 2020. It's about 2016. That election was a terrific psychic shock to the ruling class, a 9 on the political Richter scale. The regime was smug. They were confident. They had one of their own on the Democratic ticket, a reliable bot for the academic, military, technocratic, intelligence, media, financial elites. The 2016 election was lined up nicely, all according to plan. Then suddenly, from out of right field, came this wild man, this maverick, destroying all the ruling class plans. Everything out of the administrative state since November 2016, everything from the big federal power centres, the universities and law schools and military staff colleges, the broadsheet newspapers and TV channels, Hollywood and the big internet companies, the FBI and the CIA and the NSA and the so-called Justice Department, everything has been said, done, written and broadcast with the sole aim of making sure that 2016 never happens again. And that's not hyperbole. The video clips of riots in South Africa are a bit creepy, aren't they? I mean, in the way that they remind us of last year's video clips out of Minneapolis, Portland, Chicago, New York. There were some key differences. The South African riots seem not to have been explicitly anti-white. Most of the driving energy was tribal, if I'm understanding it right. One group of blacks were fired up because their guy, former President Jacob Zuma, had been jailed. The ex-president is a Zulu, and the worst of the disturbances are in the Zulu home province. The businesses being burned and looted are mostly Indian, Indians being a market-dominant minority in South Africa. Those people you've seen shooting at the looters are probably Indian too, sort of like the rooftop Koreans of Los Angeles back in the 1992 Rodney King riots. There are economic discontents in play too, and so on. Still and all, there are economic discontents all around the world, and political resentments, and market-dominant minorities, and tribes wanting to assert themselves. Yet, the two big tranches of video clips showing rioters, looters and arsonists that we have watched this past 2 years from the USA and South Africa have something in common that it's hard not to notice. Time to recycle my South Africa story. This is a Radio Durb golden oldie that first showed up in my August 10th, 2013 podcast. I apologise if you've heard it before. Never having actually been to South Africa, this is all I've got when news about the place pops up. Quote from self, slightly edited. I recall a fine example of Occam's razor from 30 or so years ago when I was doing office work in London. I had a colleague, a white guy from South Africa, who spoke with those strange flattened vowels they use. He actually pronounced the name of his country as Zuid-Afrika. Well, chatting around the office one day, I mentioned a certain district of London that was plagued with street crime. At that time, my youthful liberalism had not yet altogether worn off, so I was reaching for what Steve Saylor calls Occam's butter knife. Positing poverty, fatherlessness, lack of public facilities, and so on, as the causes of all the street crime. My Boer friend listened for a while until his patience ran out. Then he cut me off with Occam's razor. "It's the blicks, dear fellow," he said. "It's the blicks." End quote. So it is, then, now, and forever. Diversity is our strength. Well, not necessarily. Last week, England's soccer team reached their first final in a major tournament since winning the World Cup in 1966. Before proceeding with the current story, please let me just pause to remember that. I couldn't care less about soccer, then or now, but I was a young student, 21 years old, and Britain was still struggling to come to terms with its retreat from governing half the world to being just a middle-ranked nation with a balance of payments problem. Memories of World War II were still fresh, and the nation we beat in that 1966 World Cup final was Germany. It was impossible not to get swept up in the general enthusiasm. I still have my dad's commemorative beer glasses, decorated with images of World Cup Willy, the England team emblem. Okay, back to last Sunday. After all those years, 55 years, the England team had made it to a major international soccer final again. Not the World Cup this time, but the European Championship. They were playing the Italian team at Wembley Stadium in London. At full time, the game was tied 1-1. It went into extra time. Extra time was played, and the score was still stuck at 1-1. What happens then, according to the rules, is penalty shootouts. Each team selects 5 players to take solo shots at the enemy goal, which of course is defended by the enemy goalkeeper. An Italian player came up, shot at the England goal, and scored. An England guy came up, shot at the Italian goal, and scored. So, 1-1 on the penalty shots. The second of the 5 Italian guys came and missed. The second England guy came up and scored. Wild jubilation in the stands. England ahead, 2-1 on penalties. There were still 3 guys on each side to kick, though. Italy's number 3 came up and scored. England's number 3 came up and missed. Italy's number 4 came up and scored. England's number 4 came up and missed. Italy's number 5 came up and missed. England's number 5 came up and missed. Score on penalties, 3 for Italy, 2 for England. Italy won. Wailing and gnashing of teeth in the stands. What got everybody's attention was that of those 5 England players picked to take the penalty shots, the first 2 were white, and they both scored. The last three were black, and they all missed. That led predictably to some rude commentary on social media. And that, in turn, stirred up a mighty howling gale of virtue signalling. There don't seem to have been a really large number of rude comments about the three black players, but any quantity is enough to stir up the establishment and those who, sheep-like, acknowledge the establishment's moral authority, which is to say about 90% of English people today. When I said the establishment there, that includes the soccer establishment. Gareth Southgate, the England team manager, is perfectly woke. So much so, he has supported his team genuflecting before each international game, taking a knee out of respect to the anti-white, violent anarchist gang BLM, and to honour the memory of junkie street criminal George Floyd. Peace be upon him. Southgate's reflexive wokeism inspired a July 9th essay by Ed West at unheard.com, which I strongly recommend to your attention. Ed's column defies synopsis, but I'll give you a sample quote. Quote, "The past 50 years or so have seen a cultural revolution in Western society comparable in scope to the Reformation. Most of us have known only that period of transition, when morality and norms were up for debate. But perhaps it is now over. Perhaps we have returned to the sort of world we lived in when England last reached a final in 1966. A world of strictly enforced social mores." End quote. What does Radio Derb think of this little kerfuffle? Not much. Having, as I already said, having no interest in soccer, and coming up to my 20th year as a US citizen, with only feebly sentimental feelings about the old country, I'm not much bothered. All right, I'll try to be bothered. First, I'll take the side of those three black players who missed their goals. They are all Englishmen, black Englishmen, born and raised there. Two are from London, the other is from Lancashire, my father's ancestral county. One of the Londoners has Nigerian parents, the other two are of West Indian parentage, or partly so. One, I think, is a quadroon. Nobody can help who his parents are or where he's born, so it wouldn't make much sense to nurse any personal negativity to the three. Good luck to them. And on the same grounds, it's a bit ill-mannered to be abusing them on social media. On the other hand, these are international-level soccer players we're talking about. That is a very well-paid line of work, much better paid than any line of work I was ever in. If, shielded by all that moolah, if one or more of the three was to have a nervous breakdown because somebody called him a rude word on Twitter, he would have revealed himself to be a contemptible pussy, and I wouldn't hesitate to say so. Furthermore, bad manners towards groups favoured by the establishment, blacks, Muslims, homosexuals and so on, have been criminalised in the UK. This week, unknown hundreds, perhaps thousands, of British bobbies have been taken off homicide squads, anti-drug units, burglary investigations and other lines of criminal investigation, all much less important than bad manners. And they are now working double shifts to track down the social media abusers and bring them to justice. I mean, of course, social justice, which is far and away the most important kind. My opinion of the three black players would be higher if they would issue a joint public statement saying that they don't want anyone's door being kicked down by bobbies at 3 a.m. just on suspicion of the door's owner having tweeted, "Go back to Nigeria." What do you say, guys? No, I'm not holding my breath. And now to take the side of the abusers. They are voices from out of the pit. The pit into which they have been cast by the cultural revolution that Ed West writes about. Perhaps, like me, perhaps they remember the England team that won the 1966 World Cup. And they're contrasting it in their minds with this year's team. The cultural revolution over there is not complete. Lenin wanted to create new Soviet man. Our own cultural commissars have been striving to create new multicultural man. The latter effort has been considerably successful, much more so than Lenin's, and more so in Britain than in the USA. There are still resistors, though. There are still Englishmen who can't forget that not very long ago they were part of a nation with a supermajority of people like themselves, people of the same race, sharing the same proud history, the same mythology, the same culture. They can't forget that England was once a nation. Now, it's just a place. The resistors resent that bitterly, and sometimes, ignited by something trivial like a soccer defeat, the resentment boils over into bad manners. Not to worry, though. The authorities will soon have them all tracked down and hustled off to jail or re-education camps. You can't let people like that run around loose. Heck, there might be an insurrection. As I said back there, soccer is not my game. In the England of my childhood, the class system was still going strong, and games that involved kicking balls had a class angle. Working class people played and watched football, which is to say soccer. But the middle classes played and watched rugby. Well, that's how it was in the Midlands, anyway. Up in the north of England, there was a variant style of rugby called rugby league. It was working class, like soccer. I tell you, the class system was complicated. In what follows, I shall ignore rugby league. Rugby, as far as I'm concerned, is rugby union. The catchphrase was, "Soccer is a game for gentlemen played by hooligans. Rugby is a game for hooligans played by gentlemen." The point of that, aside from the class angle, is that rugby is a much rougher game with lots of body contact. Well, in my elementary school, we all played soccer, in my case, without enthusiasm or success. At age 11, though, I graduated into the town's premier boys' school, which was a rugby school, determined to turn us working-class street urchins into gentlemen. Did I mention that rugby is a rough game? In that opening season, while still learning the rules, and having failed to learn one particular rule, I had my very first experience of being knocked unconscious. Nothing deterred, I played rugby once or twice every week for 4 years thereafter, to no distinction whatever. With the soccer-rugby contrast planted thus in my mind so long ago, I was curious to see whether the gentleman's game, my game, rugby, is as woke as soccer over there. Some quick Googling brought back mixed results. Where genuflecting is concerned, the governing bodies of rugby have left it to the player's individual choice. The Calcutta Cup, for instance, is a huge event in the rugby calendar, played every year between England and Scotland. Before this year's game in London, February 11th, 16 players on the England team genuflected before the game. There are 23 names listed on the squad altogether, including replacements, so that means that 7 England players did not genuflect. Scotland also listed 23 players, but only 4 took a knee to show their support for crime and anarchy in a country 3,000 miles away where nobody ever heard of rugby. Oh, Scotland won the game, 11-6. So, the English are genuflecting like crazy, the Scots much less so. What about the Welsh and Irish? As it happened, they had played each other at a game in Wales 4 days before the Calcutta Cup. None of the players on either team genuflected. Wales won the game 21-16. Given what I've been telling you about modern Ireland being the heart of wokeness, that's a bit surprising. I shall have to dig around some more and find out what's going on there. Congratulations to the Welsh players for that win anyway, and good luck in your game against Argentina tomorrow, lads. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. I have a very slight interest in Walt Whitman. I find his poetry completely unreadable. If a poet wants me to give up my time to reading him, his verses must satisfy not less than 2 of the following 3 conditions. 1. It rhymes. 2. It scans. 3. It makes sense. The score on those 3 conditions has to be 2 or 3. The few pieces of Whitman's verse that have been offered to me were 1s and 0s. Sorry, pal. However, 3 miles south of my house here on Long Island is the Walt Whitman Birthplace and Museum. That is my very slight interest. I have only been to the birthplace once. That's when Steve Saylor was staying over with us, and we were struggling to think of local attractions that Steve might find entertaining. We took him to the dwarf tossing contest, the quilting social, the aardvark races, and the all-island flatulence final, and then, unable to think of anything else, we showed him the Whitman birthplace. Steve was quietly respectful. That aside, I have retained no memory of the birthplace at all. Now I see that Whitman has been cancelled. A statue of the old shirtlifter on the campus of Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey, is to be, quote, relocated to a historically relevant site on campus and contextualized, end quote. Why? Why do you think? Quote, he stood for white supremacy and racism against black and indigenous Americans, end quote. Translation, he was a white guy and not a communist. That last quote was from a petition circulated by student activists last year. I have a suggestion for these activists. The Whitman birthplace here on Long Island occupies a fair-sized slab of prime real estate on a main shopping street, right opposite Mrs. Derbyshire's favourite shopping mall. We sure could use another parking lot down there. Some of the birthplace buildings are old wooden structures. They would burn real easy. Item. Just going back to the South Africa disturbances for a moment, I see that the son of jailed ex-president Jacob Zuma, who is said to have political ambitions of his own, the son issued the following plea to the rioters, quote, for the people that are protesting and looting, please do so carefully. And please do so responsibly. End quote. I hereby nominate Zuma Jr. for the 2021 award of the Nancy Pelosi Looter Encouragement Trophy. Item. Tuesday around 5:17 p.m., a George Floyd memorial in Toledo, Ohio, was destroyed by a bolt of lightning. The jokes write themselves. So much so, the humble commentator can only direct you to what he thinks is the wittiest comment thread. My vote is for the one at Ace of Spades. Item. I don't know much about Brazilian politics, and I'm always ready to have my understanding improved, but current President Jair Bolsonaro seems like a pretty good egg. At any rate, he's hated by all the right people. I am therefore sorry to report that President Bolsonaro has come down with a very bad case of the hiccups. He's been hiccuping uncontrollably since July 3rd. That's a lot of hiccups. I don't have any medical expertise in this area, but I can offer some of the folk remedies current in my English childhood. Stand on your head and clap your feet was my father's usual suggestion. I'm not sure he meant it seriously. At any rate, I never mastered that particular manoeuvre. My mother favoured dropping a key, a cold metal key, down your back between undershirt and skin. I can't remember if that ever worked, but at least it didn't involve knocking over large items of furniture. Outside the family, among school classmates and neighbours, drinking a glass of water backwards, that is, from the wrong side of the glass, was popular. I remember finding it efficacious, but impossible to do without getting either A, water up your nose, or B, a soaking wet shirt front. And then there was shock therapy, a sudden sharp noise right behind you. Bang! I was going to recommend that one to President Bolsonaro's colleagues. Then I thought, wait, a Latin American country? The presidential palace? a sudden sharp noise right behind you? Perhaps not. I think, Mr. President, you should try the glass of water backwards. That's all I have, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your time and attention. Having wished the Welsh rugby team well for tomorrow's game against Argentina back there, and being, because of a minor calamity, being in need of something soothing, I thought I would give you a Welsh lullaby to play us out. Nothing's more soothing than a lullaby, right? Here is the Welsh lullaby, Sir Gân, a lovely folk ditty at least 200 years old. Sir Gân just means lullaby, and the words are pretty much the words of every lullaby from everywhere. Sleep, my precious, sleep, your mummy's here, nobody can harm you, and so on. It's actually sung here in Welsh by the Welsh soprano Emily Parry Williams, but it has a Wikipedia page with a translation if you're curious. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.